So, good evening. Carolyn, it's wonderful to see you. I've not only brought the book, I brought another calendar that was sent to me that arrived yesterday. I brought the Pureg calendar, was it last week? A couple of weeks ago. The man who was my, I guess he was my Jisha, and also was training to be Shuso at Felsentor, took all kinds of pictures and put them together and made a very beautiful, he's a really good photographer, calendar. Not quite as complicated as the Pureg one, but with the same style. So I will leave it out so you all can see it afterward. And we are on number 18, page 44. Of this book.
Ito once asked, in the activity of the patchwork monk, the coin mends and patches old and worn out clothing and such without throwing them away, it seems that he is greedy in being sparing of things. If he discards the old and uses the new accordingly, he has a mind which is greedy in seeking what is new, there being fault in either case. Ultimately, how should one deal with this?
Dogen replied, if one just detaches from both greed in sparing and greed in seeking, there would be no impropriety in either case. However, would it not be appropriate to mend what is worn, making it last a long time, and not to covet anything new?
That always sounds to me as if there was some little problem in the monastery about that, and he was bringing it up to the master. I know somebody who... several people who took pride in how they patched their clothes. And one person who made an okesa out of scraps, the way it was done in Buddha's time. And that person did not get carried away with it, but I can just imagine that somebody might, and Ajo might be concerned and think, well, you know, even doing the most humble thing can be a prideful thing if you get carried away. It's kind of a funny question to bring up to the master, but it's the way these are. They're just homely. They're homely monastic problems that come up. I can just imagine Dogen addressing them very sensibly. So greed is the bottom line, as usual. Seems to drive the world. So I don't know. Does anybody have something to say about this? Donalyn?
That fine line of the attachment.
it's really the, you think the common sense would prevail, that if you're attached then to doing what it's, it reminds me a little bit of someone in our practice who's not interested in some of the rituals that we do, and so he doesn't do them, nor does he wear his robe like the rest of the priests. And sometimes I ask myself, well, am I so attached that I like to see it done the ritual way, or is he attached to not wanting to do the rituals? It's very,
yes,
a little bit of both. So it feels like the old and the new plot. You know? Do I really need that new plot? And, you know, that this is not going to last you the winter. It would really look nice next to that other path. So interesting, and then even thinking too much about it.
Yes, yes.
Seeing thoughtless and then too much thought. Seems like I'm always looking for that little way.
And we're in a world here where we're encouraged to be individualistic. Catherine Thanis and I were talking about this yesterday, this very subject, because there are some people in her sangha who are ordained but don't want to wear robes in the zendo. And she is a stickler for everything to be absolutely right, the way she was taught by Reb Anderson, who is an absolute stickler. So her tradition is... you don't practice your individuality in the zendo. You practice the way that you've embraced by being ordained. And yet it's very puzzling because there are people who don't want to do that. So then what? We can't beat people into submission because that isn't the point. But it's one of the conundrums that I think we have in American Zen, because Americans are so free and easy, and just, you know, it's like when I asked Todd to play the bells the regular way, and he said, "I like it my way," and he just continued to do it his way. But it's a real puzzle that I guess we just stumble along and try to work it out as best we can. On the other hand, there is Jane, who is also a stickler for doing everything exactly right, and she knows all the exactly right ways. And that can really get to be too much also. So finding that middle way in practice, it's much more relaxing to just go along with the rules and not try to do something new and different. Even if you think you like the bells better, it's still better to, it's an easier practice for your zazen if you just slip into the form that we're given. And then you don't have to think about it anymore. You just do it. And the form supports you. It holds you as you practice. It's one less thing to worry about. And as soon as you know what the schedule is, it doesn't change. It's just the same thing. So you can just ride on it so wonderfully. But then... some people feel oppressed, feel that they're being punished, or, you know, I think there are a lot of psychological issues that people get caught up in. and it's such a small, intense, intimate kind of situation that, of course, everything comes up and has to be dealt with, which is what the practice is, in a sense. We don't turn away. We actually face our neuroses, our ego trips, and at the same time, our revising Zen as it comes to America. So,
it's tricky too, because the thing comes up is what's distracting when the form isn't carried through or expected, distracting. But then you go, then I go, oh, well, you know, that's my own neurosis, that's my own thing. But it's like why we don't wear bright red or, you know, bikinis in the same week. It's part of what just slipping into the, you know, the practice. And then also, you know, the form is like, you know, how do you do, for instance, you know, formal serving when we don't have the batons, we don't have the, and so it's so much also, I noticed that you have to have the knowledge to be able to adapt also to the circumstance and to the, not just the environment, but and also the energy. It's all very, very good stuff to see. But I remember Mae Sarton, something that she said as a writer, and she said for her, routine is the most freeing thing to her. And I see that, and I, you know, I didn't get it at first, but I sure get it in gray. Just she, I mean, the bells, I mean, everything.
Yeah.
We give the form, you know, as quality as well as we can.
I've heard somewhere that discipline is freeing.
And that's it's a very Eastern thing to say, but Westerners don't understand.
and not to be negative, but I was thinking also when you're saying about when we want to do everything the way we want, and the Todd and the Bell, it feels like it's kind of constricting when you want to just, I go through it every day, like, what am I going to do? And
yeah.
It's just, it's kind of like oppressive. And
it's hard.
Yeah.
Yes. Suzuki Roshi says that in the book on Sandokai. He says that real freedom is in discipline. That once you get disciplined, then suddenly you feel completely free. It's counterintuitive, I think. We like to think that we just fling open all the doors and windows and yell and run around and do whatever we want to do, but that's not really freedom. It's just kind of a waste of energy.
Makes me think of Lee, remember? The first time I met it's him, like in the Zendo, he was doing Kenhan, but doing all these.
do you remember how he used to do that? Make all these kind of like movements going through. This Kenyan was his, you know.
Dancing?
Yeah.
It's like, that's what I go, God, I'm just really getting really stuffy and old. It's just crazy. You know?
It's Julian?
Our practice is about doing what needs to be done. At hand, and I think it doesn't even sound like there's like any real answer in the book, even like
just drop
it's like,
both
it's like the teachers, like there's certain teachers that speak, you know, whatever, bring the Dharma to the people would be more open to the Dharma from than others. It's just, that's just the way things are. That doesn't mean there's any, like, anyone is better than the other, but they're necessary. I don't know, maybe even people who kind of make a fuss about the road, or like, or not have that kind of, what would be the word, reluctance to wear the robe, so to speak, maybe even those kind of people are necessary at some point. I mean, it's mathematically probable.
That's the other side of it, Julian. That's absolutely right. Because often when things are going too well and it's all smooth and everybody's within the confines and doing it right, then something comes along to stir it all up. And I think that's really necessary. You know, we call it breaking the icon. Then we get completely attached to whatever it is, and we think this is the way it's always been. We will always have to do it this way. And this always, always is just hanging on for dear life. And then if a teacher can do it and just sort of take it away, it's shocking. And then you wake up, you know, out of that dream of holding on and attaching to something and trying to make it permanent. Because nothing is permanent. And actually the forms change. They're always changing, because we're always changing. And every time we do the Daisegaki ceremony, it's different. Even though we have the same script and we're doing it in the same place, every year it's a little bit different. It always will be. Every time we do this, it's different. Every week. This wonderful. Keeps us awake.
Yeah, on those lines, I remember I was talking about Koban's teacher, like spending 2 hours chanting. That was his practice.
Yes.
Now, I kind of did some research on it. Tell me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like even with Zen practice, like the Zazen, that, you know, that's such a foundation to us. Now, it wasn't always that way. And, like, I guess Kodo
Sawaki,
he's the one that brought the emphasis back on,
yes,
on sitting.
Yes.
I was like, that kind of, like, whoa.
Yes.
Like, gee.
And that's where we come from, is from that tradition, Kodo Sawaki tradition. It's true, and it's true still in Japan that a great many people who go to Eheji to train are there because their father was a priest of the temple, the family temple. So they, in order to inherit the family temple, they go and train at Eheji. And when they come out, they say they will never, ever sit Zazen again. They just never get the point. It's very militaristic, it's very, very strict and tough, and it's a real hazing process, among other things, and then they work them to the bone. It's amazing what they do with not much sleep for 2 or 3 years. And boy, they leave there and they say, I'm never going to do that again. No, and I don't know how Koban's teacher came to. He trained at Eheji and came out of it and became a high school teacher. I think he taught English. And that was his practice, to chant for 2 hours every morning. So he took the practice very seriously, but he didn't do Zazen.
That's
Gino.
So,
Yes. And he took Koban across the rice fields many times when somebody dies, or when it's somebody's anniversary of a death. You call the priest, and he does a lot of chanting. And Koban learned his chanting that way, by following and going along and helping him and learning to chant himself. So he was, had a fabulous chanting voice, really powerful chanting voice. But when we go over there and want to sit at AHG, people, are you sure? Do you know what you're doing? Zazen? That's for monks. And for most of Japan, it's either for monks or it's a kind of, sometimes the schools and the factories will send their teachers and workers to the monastery for a week of Zazen, sort of chill them out and find some peace and quiet, which is very wise. It's the way they've made use of the whole tradition in a layman's kind of way. So there's, at Heihachi, there's a big building that's just for visitors to come and practice. And you can go there for a week or 2 weeks. They have wonderful hot tubs and regular Japanese beds that roll out on the floor. And you get up with the monks and you run up in your tabes up the stairs and go to the ceremonies, and it's very cool. It's a wonderful thing to do. Either?
I had a question when you were talking about attachment. I think you've answered it somewhere in there, but it's, what's the relationship between self-clinging and attachment? Because it would seem where there's form of stuff, you know, the attachment comes from self-clinging.
Yes.
And you were saying that kind of realizing that everything changes, you know, maybe part of that, you know, the antidote to that understanding. But I wonder if you could say more about that, or if there is a relationship. Maybe it's the same thing.
I think it's the same thing, really, basically. That's where it comes from, that sense of self and the sense of adorning it in some way, you know, whether it's with rocks and trees or whether it's clothes or jewels, or we're always attaching ourselves and treasuring what we have. So the medicine for that is to start giving things away, to start practicing generosity. I have a friend who still, when she goes over the bridge, pays for the person behind her as well. Just makes that her lifelong practice. Well, they're going to raise the price again, I just read. It's getting really expensive. But we can do very small things like that, and they add up very quickly. Including dedicating the merit when we chant the Heart Sutra. We chant it, presumably accumulate merit for this, and then we give it all away. Well, the next one is kind of long. Actually, it's pretty simple. It just separates the practice of monks and lay people. We can read it. We don't have to really discuss it very much.
That must be
19.
After an evening talk, Iho asked, should we perform such duties as the requital of the debt of gratitude to our fathers and mothers? Dogen answered, filial piety and obedience are most certainly to be exercised.
However, in that, you know,
filiality
and obedience, there is a difference between householders and leavers of home. Householders observe such teachings as those of a classic of filial piety, serving their parents in life and serving them in death. Worldly people all know this. Because leavers of home abandon the debt of gratitude and enter into non-doing, in the manner of a leaver of home, when it comes to requital of debt, it is not limited to one person, thinking with deep gratitude of all sentient beings alike, as fathers and mothers, he returns the roots of goodness he creates back to the universe. If one were to limit it especially to his parents, in this life single generation alone, he would go against the path of non-doing.
In daily practice of the way, continuous immersion in the study, if one just goes on the following, unfollowing the way of Buddhas, that is to be considered the true way of filial piety, the dedication of offerings on death anniversaries, and the practice of good during the period of limbo are activities which lay people resort to.
The patch-robed ones should know the depth of their debt to their fathers and mothers, such as it truly is. And you should know that everything else is also like this. To specially divine a day to practice virtue, or specially choose one person to whom to dedicate it, does not seem to be the intention of the Buddha. As for the passage in the preceptual scripture about the day of death of father, mother, and siblings, this seems to be temporarily applied to householders. In the monasteries of China, although they have such ceremonies on the death anniversary of the master, it doesn't appear that they practice this on the death anniversary of the parents.
So monks take on the world. That's really what he's saying. And if you agree to leave home, quote unquote, and it doesn't mean you have to walk out the door, but it means you turn to the world and choose to serve the world just as you would serve your family. So your responsibility gets much, much bigger. It's really talking about the Bodhisattva way, which is sometimes talked about as filling a well with snow. It's such a big job. It's just not limited to one person. The Japanese have a very elaborate, it's based on the Chinese, on Confucian practice, which was powerful in China and is starting to come back. And filial piety, sort of worshiping your parents and worshiping your ancestors and feeling this powerful connection with everywhere that you came from, everyone that you came from. So they have many ceremonies about renewing over and over the connection. That when somebody dies, they have a funeral, and then a year or so afterward, they have a funeral, and then a few more years after that, they have another one. There are memorial services, and sometimes they're quite elaborate. It's one of the big ways, main ways, that temples in Japan are supported, because every time they do one of these little services, they get paid. So when I was in Suzuki Roshi's temple, just a little country temple, a family would come all dressed in black, maybe five or six people, and they would, Roshi would come in and they would sit down in the hondo, and he had a little mokugyo, and he would chant very fast, bang, 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 kanji, zaibo, zatsuko, jinhan, yaka, you know, all the way through, and then they would all bow. And then he would bring out the tea and the cigarettes, and they would all sit around, drink tea and smoke cigarettes. And then they would pay him and go back home. And that was, you know, took care of grandma for another couple of years. And then in August, they have a whole festival about the dead, where they fix up the gravestones and have, you know, dances. The whole town gets together and feasts and dances around where they came from. I always think of it as it's a powerful recognition of source, the genetic source of us, I guess you could say. The biological source of us. What the monks are focusing on is the greater source, you could say, which includes the small one, but is not the focus for a monastic. It was a perfect thing for you to read. The paragraph you did, that was so sweet. It's just what you're doing.
Well, I don't have it. I'm not doing it out of a sense of duty.
No, I know. It's such a natural thing to do, and that's what he's saying here. It's a completely natural thing to do. Of course we do. Well, it's 8 o'clock.